Hello, OT friends, and welcome to the Uncommon OT series. My name is Patricia Modis. I'm the Transitions OT, and I'm your host. So today, I'm very excited to introduce you to our guest of honor. Our guest of honor is Megan Blau. Megan is an interior designer based in sunny California. Her interior design career started with a personal journey to renovate and adapt her first home to fit accessibility needs while having a high level of style. In 2009, she incurred a C6 to C8 spinal cord injury and has been a wheelchair user ever since. She is diagnosed with an incomplete C8 spinal cord injury, which has obviously changed the way she lives in the blink of an eye. As a person with a disability, it seemed the majority of options to make homes accessible were straight up ugly and very hospital-like. It got her thinking that we can do better than this. So combining her perspective of disability with her lifelong passion for interior design fueled Megan to find creative ways to make spaces beautifully accessible. In 2018, she started Blue Copper Design to elevate the world of adaptive design. So without further ado, I would like to present to you Megan Blau. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks, Patricia. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You are a very special guest to us because typically I interview uncommon OTs who are working out there in uncommon settings. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about the fact that although you're not an OT, you have a personal journey that you've gone through that really makes you an expert in the work that you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely do. And, you know, throughout that journey, I've worked with several OTs and PTs and all kinds of therapists. So I have a little bit of insight onto like what your world is. And then in the career that I've started too, I've also, you know, worked with other OTs in a more professional setting.
Yeah. So we're going to pick your brain a little bit about that and really look forward to hearing about the work that you do. Because as an OT myself, having worked with clients in their residential programs and in their residences and their primary homes, I understand the relevance of all of this and the importance of all of this and how it really does, you know, it's a quality of life issue, in my opinion. And I so look forward to hear about what you have to say. But before delving into that, as usual, I'd like to ask you to share a little bit about yourself. I know we already talked a little bit about your background and your experiences in your bio, but maybe anything more you can share.
Oh, wow. Well, it's been a journey. So like the bio said, I am a wheelchair user. I have a spinal cord injury. I'm technically a quadriplegic. I do have high hands and arm function for what like normally a quadriplegic would look like. So I've been told anyways. So yeah, that's kind of been where this part of my life has started. I mean, that's really where like my adult life started because I was 17 when my accident happened. So, yeah, the past 12 years, I've been learning how to live in a wheelchair. So, I mean, to elaborate on that a little bit more, you know, like most people, I had a couple months in the hospital, an inpatient, and then pretty much my full, like a full year of outpatient therapy. And I really remember like I was living with my parents at the time. I was 17. And I remember having their home be like really not adapted. And that was like a huge problem, obviously, because overnight you're dealing with like a traumatic event of becoming quadriplegic and becoming paralyzed. And that affects so many people. Mm-hmm. And then on top of it, like you're kind of having to make shift a renovation.
Yes.
So that's like very stressful in and of itself. So I didn't really have to deal with that part. Like I had family and my parents kind of dealt with that. But I remember it being like a stress on me for sure. Like, you know, feeling like, oh, like now we have to figure out how this home is going to work for me. And we figured it out. And then from their house, I went off to college. I lived in the dorms and that was like my first real experience with what accessibility could be. So I had a really great, like, accessible dorm room. I didn't have to share it with anyone, which was really nice. Or most, a lot of people did. I mean, that was a perk, I'm not gonna lie.
And was that were the doorways wider and the bathroom bigger and all
Yeah,
of that
so
stuff?
yep, the doorway was wider. It had a button door, like a button opener door. I can't really remember. It did have like a little kitchen setup. I don't remember that being super accessible. But then it also, like, the bathroom was up to ADA code. So all of that was awesome. And from then I like really didn't have to think about my space, if that made sense. Like, it wasn't a concern anymore. I could just live and go to school and do my college life. And it wasn't until college life was coming to an end and I was trying to figure out where to go next, where like accessibility became like an issue again for me.
Yes, got it.
So yeah, it's, and I know like we've heard this story so many times from people with disabilities or people who are aging in place and everything like that. Like, accessibility, just like, it's not a problem until it is a problem. But for me, like, it's always a problem now. Like, now that I've seen both sides, I'm like, no, this is like an actual problem always. Like, it's just always a problem
Yes.
and always a concern.
Yes, I lived in New York City for many years, and this was such a commuting just from point A to point B was a typical goal for a lot of our clients. And just because there's so many barriers, right? Just, people, schedules, subways, elevators breaking down, sidewalks, that are inaccessible for wheelchair users. So I'm so glad you're on the show. So tell us a little bit more about your interior design work and this the work that you do, perhaps the clients that you serve and the needs that you're addressing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, really my interior design journey like began right after college. So I went to college, got a degree in environmental studies, so nothing to do with interior design. But I was with my boyfriend, who's my husband now, and we were wanting to move in together, and we were looking for apartments, and it was just so hard to find an accessible one. So I was like, well, let's look into like home ownership. Let's see if that will work for us. And it did. We ended up purchasing a home, and in that process, it dawned on me, like, I'm always going to have to renovate. Like, no home is going to be made for me. I'm always going to have to make changes. So, like, let's go, let's do this. We hired a contractor who was a friend of ours. And that whole process was interesting because even though I was really used to living at that time, living in like an ADA compliant space, translating that into my home seemed like too much for me. Like, I didn't need everything in what the ADA was specifying for like a public space. I didn't need that in my personal home. So that was kind of like an obstacle that I had to overcome with contractors and like really explain myself, really advocate for myself once again, because contractors and tradesmen, they're usually really knowledgeable in the ADA. They know the guidelines, the basics at least are pretty easy to keep in your head. But in order to execute that in this specific house would have taken a lot more time, a lot more money, a lot more material, and it just like was overkill for me. So I was like, okay, let's don't think of the ADA, like just listen to what I'm saying that I need. And it worked out. So we went through that whole renovation. That was our first house. I learned a lot. I didn't really know what I was doing. I was 20 years old and I was renovating a house. So but I fell in love. I fell in love with the process. Simultaneously, I was working at a retail store and I was doing their visual merchandising. So I fell in love with like creativity and like design practices and things like that in my job. I could see how that translated into home design, and like something just clicked for me where I was like, okay, like design is where it's at for you. Like, you definitely want to be creative. So let's decide like how to pursue this. And I was like, for sure, interiors. Like, that's where I can make a difference. Because throughout that whole time, like me, like a lot of people, I was obsessed with like HGTV and like design shows. And I was like, I would love to have that experience for myself without having to like advocate for myself once again. So That's another thing with like people with disabilities, they're constantly having to advocate for themselves. And that is something that I've learned in therapy from OTs, PTs, doctors, nurses. They're like, okay, like this is your life now. This is how you're going to have to advocate. But that can get really exhausting. And especially in a world that you don't know a lot about, where there's a lot of consequences. Like if you mess up your home, it's not easy or cheap to fix most of the time. So it's like, okay, but I'm not really an expert, but I kind of have to be an expert. And then I'm relying on other experts, and everyone's relying on each other. So that's where my idea started, to start my own design business. And it took a couple years for me to think about it, do some research. I did end up going back to school for a design certificate just to get like, a little bit more concrete on what actual good design principles are. And and then I always knew I wanted my own business, but I also did work for other people. And I just was constantly daydreaming about like, okay, like we really need to solve this accessibility problem. And we need to solve it in a way that's like treating people as if they would have been treated with or without a disability, as far as like personal style and design. And I felt like that was the piece that I had to really hold on to in my first renovation. So that's kind of a long story, but it started from a personal journey. And from there, like it's been really received like really well. So I started Blue Copper Design in 2018 with the goal to blend accessible interiors and beautiful interiors. And really, that's just what we do. So we service people with accessibility needs. We service people who have like family or friends with accessibility needs, or they want to prepare for the future. Maybe they already want to go under a renovation, but they want to plan for aging in place, or, God forbid a catastrophe happens or anything like that. So that's who we service. But we also, we service non-adaptive people as well. And that's where like the beauty comes in for us and the creativity. And we're an interior design firm first, and we just apply that like filter of accessibility for our clients who need it.
Well, that's all such wonderful stuff and so needed, right? I think our OT listeners will definitely be able to relate to the client-centeredness approach that you have to your work. I loved when you said, I know what the ADA says, but listen to me because my voice is, I have to live here.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a good place to start. Like the ADA obviously has its purpose, and it's great for public spaces. And like that's a whole other section and a whole other problem of like public spaces not even being up to ADA. But we go beyond that. So we use them as guidelines. We use them as great like benchmarks for things. But if the space is too hard to adapt in a residential setting, or the client needs more than what the ADA says, or less than what the ADA says, like we really just listen to our clients and use the ADA as guidelines.
Got it. Would you be able to describe to our listeners a little bit what a typical day might be like for you? Meaning, you get a call from a client. How do you go through sort of like your assessment process? I forgot you have a really great term. I was looking at the services that you offered, and I guess maybe that's, part of how you can explain, because there's an evaluation phase, but then there was also a virtual type of evaluation.
Yeah, absolutely. So we offer three different kinds of services, and that also kind of sprouted from the idea that like good design should be accessible to all people. So our first service, which is the most involved, is full service design. And that is start to finish, from consultation to installation, pillow fluffing, everything like that, project management, the kind of stuff you do see on TV, where it's, we're sourcing everything for you, ordering everything for you, delivering everything all the way through. And then also, if there's any renovation, like managing that with a contractor. So that's the most involved. Our second tier, I guess, would be virtual design. So this is for people who like want guidance, but they also need the flexibility of time and purchasing over time. So not everyone has, the funds or the will or the need to like furnish an entire room all at one time. But they're like, oh, it would just be great if, you can give me some directions. So a lot of my are these other two services kind of came from like our clients or even like my friends. Because I'm still very young and I understand a lot of people in their 20s are not in, really looking to hire an interior designer financially, but they want to make good design decisions. So for virtual design, we give renderings and instructions, create a design plan for you, but we use retail sources and send a list. So with links and everything. So you can purchase on your own time, over time. And we can do that with like very light renovations too. Give like detailed instructions so you can like hand our packet off to your contractor and hopefully they'll understand what we're talking about. And then our third service is accessibility consulting. So this is just a one-time 90-minute consulting service where we'll meet with anyone. I mean, we've met with homeowners before, contractors. It's also designed to, for other interior designers or even occupational therapists who are managing the project themselves and they just want a little bit of guidance. Like they just want to pick our brain on accessibility. Like, what do you see? How can we make this more accessible? And then we, of course, throw in good design practices too, because we can't help ourselves. So, yeah, I mean, from an occupational therapist standpoint, that might be like the most beneficial because I always say, whenever I meet an OT, I'm like, you guys are like mini designers and you're not really getting paid enough for that because you're the ones that people go to in the beginning where they're like, how do I make my space work? And you guys are the ones who are trained to figure that out. But in my experience, it's been more of like a make it work situation because we have like a timeline and a budget constraint, and it's not so much like a full process.
Would you be able to describe to us in a little bit more detail what an accessibility consultation might look like? Like if you maybe an example of of a client or a case that you've had recently?
Yeah, of course. So, all of our services start with a phone call. So I like to get to know people and figure out, what they're thinking, kind of place them into a service. So if accessibility consulting was the service for them, we would schedule a Zoom call. That way we can share screens. You can send us documents before to review. And we just kind of start at the beginning and go all the way through. It's really just like your as the person, as our client, like you have the floor to our brain and we get as much in as possible. So a lot of people will share their floor plan. So if they're already working with an architect or a builder or a contractor, we usually share the screen or I ask, to send it beforehand. We have that pulled up and we just go like space by space, area by area. From an OT perspective, you would probably be doing that for your client. So I would want to know, some details without any violation, of course, of just how your client would be using the space. And then we would make recommendations from there. So we'll send you notes afterwards. And then that way you feel like you have more guidance and a little bit more empowerment to, make the changes.
Got it. Thank you for sharing that. I think those details are really helpful for our listeners. Can you tell us how you get paid for your services?
Yeah, sure. So we have a whole payment structure. They're as simple as they can be. So for full service design, we do an in-person consultation, which has a $300 fee. If our clients decide to move forward with that, after the consultation, we'll give them a proposal of what we propose our design hours to be like and our design fee. So we bill hourly for that service. And we just base that off of previous projects or, different, I guess, aspects of the project, like if it has something different. So that's how we come up with our design hours. We take a 20% retainer and then we bill monthly from that, just on the design hours that we use. And then the retainer is applied towards the last bill.
Got it.
And then if there's any refund, we just refund our clients, which there usually isn't, but sometimes there is. Virtual design is a room by room service. So we will, if it's a kitchen, that's a one room. If it's a living room, that's another room. We also have a great room fee, like an add-on fee, because I don't know how it is everywhere else, but in Arizona, we have a lot of great rooms where it's like an open living dining room space. So that's Yeah, we'll work with you on like deciding how many rooms that would be. And
Okay.
then that's just 50% up front and 50% when your design package is delivered. And then the same with accessibility consulting. So 50% when you schedule, 50% after our meeting.
Got it.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing your payment structure. Does insurance ever factor in here?
You know, no, we haven't done anything with insurance. To be honest, I don't know how that would work with medical insurance. I mean, getting like medical equipment that we would plan put into our design plan, definitely like Hoyer lifts or shower chairs or commode chairs, things like that. We are looking into like other kinds of funding though, like through vocational rehab,
Yes.
or like other nonprofit organizations that fund home modifications. So technically, I guess we could be considered home modifications, but we really are design first, like I said. But
Yes.
we're working on convincing people that, like, yeah, we're home modifications, but like, and then some. So even
Yes.
if, you know, we got partial funding for some of the renovation, that would be really helpful for our clients. So if our clients came to us with that kind of funding in mind, totally we'll figure out how to work with them for that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. I think that's a great service because sometimes
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
navigating the resources and first of all finding that there's even this resource available and then applying and navigating. That's usually not an easy process too, right?
Yeah, that's
So
like a whole other beast in and of itself.
yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think that again, it's a great service to offer. And thank you for sharing, your payment structure, how that works in your business. Can you share with us now some recent successes and perhaps some recent challenges that you've had?
Yeah, absolutely. So, one of our recent successes, which also is kind of a challenge, so I might use it for both. We are starting to service full service design out of state. So, accessibility consulting and virtual design, we've had a lot of out of state clients because it's a virtual service. But we have recently traveled to Idaho for a family with two daughters with disabilities, and they use wheelchairs. So that's been a really big success just to kind of branch out of, you know, our boundaries. And I mean, obviously that comes with challenges too, but I would say that like a lot of those challenges have been mitigated kind of because of 2020, and we had to shift and do more things virtual, that it really showed us like, oh, okay, like we can actually do a lot of things
Yes, I agree.
virtually. So that challenge has kind of been overcome. But I would say another challenge physically is we do get a lot of clients that it's a family structure and like one person has the disability. And in this case, it's children, which is a completely different ball game and has completely different needs than if it was an adult, because for the most part, they don't like the children are not going to be cooking, they're not going to be bathing themselves, you know, they don't really need that independence in the home, if that makes sense, as far as functionality. But what they do need is to feel included and part of the family and make sure that there's space in all of the rooms to where, like, you know, their play mats can be set up and their wheelchairs can be, and they're not like in a separate area, which is what the family experienced before they moved into this house. So that's really been our main goal, is keeping the family unit together and then creating the space for that to happen. Yeah, so it's almost, you know, all of our function that we know about how to, like, you know, make a sink accessible and a shower accessible, we don't really have to worry about that. It's more of like the totality of the family.
And again, something else that our OT listeners can relate to, right? It's really looking at the whole family unit and how they all interact. There's this interdependence amongst each other that kind of takes place. And that's also really important, right? Like you stated, in terms of one feeling like they belonged and they're accepted and that there isn't really anything else different. I think that's also another thing that I want to highlight is that in my experience, a lot of the folks that I worked with that were different, right, or felt different, didn't want to be excluded to feel different and didn't want to have special circumstances created for them, right? So as fluid as that can be, I think that's the most respectful way to kind of go about it. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I have so many thoughts on that. So I've grown up here in Arizona. That's where we're based, and I have really experienced like a really nice level of accessibility. And I've been to 49 other states, so I have a lot to compare against. And I understand now, like, I was like, oh, Arizona is like a very unique spot because we are a newer state. We have newer buildings. We have, it's a flat terrain. So there's not even like a lot of steps to begin with. There's a lot of factors involved into what making where I live like highly accessible. But then Patricia, to your point, like I've been to New York City and I in Boston and like, you know, older parts of the like New England area and the East Coast, I have never felt more like other than when I was in those cities. And I know people navigate it every single day and my hat goes off to them. And it's kind of like, you don't know what you don't know, but I constantly was having to look for the little wheelchair sign and the handicap symbol and the arrows and like, okay, everyone goes this way, but you go this way. Like everyone can get off on this subway stop, but you can only get off like every fours or something like that it is in New York. And I was like, okay, like I just felt very other. And I, you know, after having not having that feeling for so long, I was like, ah, this is ridiculous. Like I never want to feel this way. And I, you know, and I know that there's probably millions of people, even in our country, that do feel that way and have to kind of deal with those things. And even in California, like there's a lot of like separate entrances, separate pathways for wheelchair users or people with disabilities or mobility aids or, you know, all of that stuff. So yeah, it does make you feel like the other and you don't want to feel like that in your own home.
Yes, particularly, right? If anywhere else, at least not anywhere else.
Yeah. And that's really where like my philosophy started. I was like, okay, if my space, if my home and my area works for me, then I can take on more. Like I can take on more from the outside world. I can deal with inaccessible, you know, inaccessibility and these kinds of issues. And knowing that I have a place to go home and that I'm safe and I'm comfortable and I don't have to worry about like falling every transfer. And I still to this day, I mean, I've thought that for years. I still to this day, like really believe that more today than ever. And I, you know, I hope to bring that to our clients.
Yes. And it's such, those are such important words. And I'm so glad to have you on the show so that we can announce all of this, right? And really amplify it to the rest of the world. Because, you know, a lot, I also, another thing also with individuals who may feel like they're the other also have, they tend to also not advocate for their needs because of feeling like the other, right? You know, that's why I think us healthcare professionals who work so closely and kind of, you know, see firsthand what our clients are going through really need to help amplify these voices.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you think about it, if you have to advocate for yourself in getting out of your house for transportation and then wherever you're going, you have to like, you know, say, I need it this way. Like, can you open the door for me? Can you move this for me? That's a form of advocation. If you're going to the grocery store and you're constantly having to like ask someone to reach things for you, like all of those things throughout the day really add up. And then you do it day after day after day. And then like you were saying, like even like we shouldn't have to spend the majority of our day like scheduling transportation. Like I just don't think we need to live in that world because there's people in the disability community that don't live in that world. And I feel lucky to be one of those people. I also understand it did take a lot of work and it took a lot of other people advocating for me as well. And so that's not a position that everyone is in, you know what I mean? So it really does sadden me when I see people like, okay, like I can do one thing today because of my transportation, or, you know, I can't do that because it takes me a lot longer to get ready in my house because it's not set up for me correctly, or I have to wait for somebody to help me in my own house. But if it was set up fine, then I could be independent. Like our spaces should not dictate how independent we are.
Yes.
Not at all.
I totally agree. And this also, you know, again, amplifying this voice and having everybody really see the other side, you know, from a healthcare professional, I think of the word accommodation as a as a freeing word, right? And then yet here you are, you're saying that asking for accommodations is not very freeing. In fact, it's exhausting. So, I really appreciate you sharing that with me and with our listeners, because that's a really insightful, I've just gained so much insight by hearing you say that. I think it's important for us to hear that.
And it, I think we have like two parts of the world. Like we have a part of the world that is waiting to get up to accommodations, and then we have a part of the world that's like, okay, we're past accommodations. So it's very confusing, and I think it depends on where you are in your community and everything like that. But like here I am trying to like be like, oh, I don't need the ADA. Meanwhile, there's like people in other places that are like, I don't even have like a accessible bathroom in my grocery store. Like, there's two different problems going on, and it's interesting. So yeah, I think that's where like universal design could definitely come into play in the, next couple decades. Like I hope to see some more shifts towards that, because that kind of does take the principle of looking at the space and the situation as a whole and then designing for that, as opposed to like check the box, check the box, check the box. This is ADA, but it like might not work for everyone. Even the ADA doesn't work for everyone. So, and whatever they're, let's say a parking lot needs like two accessible spaces to be ADA compliant. They check that box and they move on. Okay, but you're in a retirement community. Like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, well, maybe we could put in like, can we put in 10? Like, I don't know. Like, it's just looking at something like in a logistical way as a whole and being like, is that like, do I need more than what they're saying?
It
Like,
still needs
stop
to
doing the
be
bare minimum.
tailored.
Yeah,
It
completely
still
tailored.
needs to be tailored. Wow, this is such a great conversation. Thank you again. Do you have any advice for our OT listeners? This working in home adaptations, accessibility, this is also an area for OTs that I think, we've already established is super important to get into, but it's also gaining a lot of interest. Do you have any advice for listeners who might want to get into this field specifically?
Yeah, I would say that it's a pretty easy bridge between design and home modifications. I still think that they're totally different in the way that you approach the problem in the beginning. But if you're interested in design, like I don't want to be the only one. I like welcome the competitiveness and the competition and the colleagues. So like, yeah, my advice would be to do it if you are thinking about like transitioning into design. My other advice would be to call out accessibility where you see it. And this is something that, I personally struggle with. So it's not, whenever I say this, it's advice to myself as well. But, if you go into a bathroom and you notice they don't have a handicap stall, like bring that up to somebody, bring that up to the manager or, a clerk or something in a nice way. I think that that piece is missing. I think too often people get angry and then they're like, I need a lawyer. But I think like that could be step one. And I've personally seen change with that. And I think that we can make a lot of change. And then if it doesn't happen, we can get into hiring a lawyer and doing all of that stuff. But I think like really making this known and being like, hey, like this is why it's important, not just like you're not compliant, you didn't check your box. It's like, no. Like, for example, I went to a bowling alley recently with some friends and I went into the women's restroom and they didn't have a handicap stall. And I was like, no, that's gonna not be good for me, but oh well, I'll deal. And then I was going by and I noticed like the doors to the bathroom were open. I noticed the men's room had a handicap stall. And I was like, well, that's interesting. Why would one have a handicap stall and not the other? And I used the men's room, which I don't know, that might be illegal. Come and arrest me, I guess. I don't know. There was no one in it. It wasn't very busy, but I was like, gosh, like I need to tell someone about this, like this shouldn't happen. Like, is there, why are we only accommodating like quote men disabled people almost? And it's not about feminism. It's just, I would have said the same thing if it's in the female room. It's like, why did it work in this application and not this application? If I brought it up to the management and like kind of explained my story, I would have a hard time thinking someone couldn't be empathetic to that. So that is my biggest advice that I always like to share with people. And it doesn't always have to come from the disability community.
It could be from a
Anyone who
business, a
recognizes it.
patron. Yes,
Yeah, anyone who
exactly.
recognizes it. Because, also I I do empathize with people because I was not always disabled, that you don't know what's accessible and not accessible. But I do think people in the therapy field probably have a better idea.
Yes, absolutely. I know when I'm walking down a New York City sidewalk and I see a bunch of cracks or I see some kind of obstacle and I just think, oh my gosh, how was, I kind of utter something to myself.
Like that's a massive
Yes.
wheelie right there.
And especially during snowstorms, this was always a
Oh.
thing. I mean, there would be puddles where, that divot is where you're supposed to go through
Yes.
to get into the sidewalk. I mean, it's always puddle ridden, and if you're in a motorized chair, I mean, you can't even get wet those
Right,
days.
yeah. Short circuited for sure.
Yes. And we've had many actually clients, it's not funny at all, but get stuck, and I say that because we've had to actually go get them and push them. And it's just, that's why I think that this is such an important topic. And I'm sorry about that you had to go through that experience. Were you able to get in touch with someone at the
I
business?
wasn't, to be
Okay.
honest, I wasn't, but I do have a little list that I keep to like circle back with people
Okay.
and poke them again and be like, hey,
I
did
love that.
you call this stall person yet? Because I don't know how expensive stalls are, but I can't imagine that they're that much, to be honest. So.
Yes. But yeah, I like that you have that list. Well, thanks again for sharing your personal experiences and your challenges, because I think that really, helps us see and understand what you might go through, right, on a typical day, and things that we may not necessarily be so really sensitive to. So I think it's really important for all of our listeners to really pay attention to all of the pieces that you're sharing. I also think that our listeners can definitely relate to your process, the process of really looking at the person, again, your client-centeredness, and then combining that with your design perspective and also your design skills, right? And I think for OTs, our ability to really look at the person and how they're able to interact within their environment really matches so well with what you described. And I like to just highlight that because part of the show also, what we try to highlight are the specific skills, the specific OT skills that may come into play when you're working in a specific type of setting. And I think, having that skill set or those skill sets would really make us also good candidates for this role.
Absolutely.
So thank you for sharing your advice. Are there any myths or misconceptions about working in your role that you might want to demystify?
I would say I feel that interior design in itself is normally thought of as like a luxury service. And to an extent, it is a luxury service. However, I think it's like an accessible luxury. Like not to use accessible again, but it really is. And so that is also another stigma of design that I'm trying to break through too. And we're doing that with our three different services at like completely different price points and trying to meet people where they're at. I just don't think that good design should be limited for the ultra wealthy. I think that it benefit like especially in the accessibility like realm, it benefits so much, but it can benefit everyone. Like I think last year we really got a taste of what home is and how important it is, and the rest of the world is not as promised. So making your own space work for you and also be somewhere you want to be. I know it can boost people's mood for sure. It can just better lives in general. So that is a myth that I think would shock people. Like if you have been stalking a designer on Instagram and you're like, I don't know, like I've thought about it, but it's not something I could afford, reach out, see if it is. Like I think people would be surprised. There's definitely designers that cater themselves to a certain class or, a certain price range, but not everyone. So
Yes.
that's something I would like to do, like break down. And to be honest, I'm gonna give it to my girl Joanna Gaines. I think she did a really good job with her show Fixer Upper on there because they were ordinary, like middle class, clients. So
Clients, yes.
sorry, my dogs are in the background if you hear that, but
That's
it
okay.
wasn't these like ultra rich people with $20,000 chandeliers, like,
Yeah. And I thank you for bringing up that great point. And it's all up to your budget. It's all up to your needs. It's all up to whatever you're ready for, whenever you're ready for it, right? It's all, you're basically in the driver's seat and you're there to sort of assist wherever everyone is in the process.
Yeah, exactly.
Sounds super OT too.
Yeah.
So thank you so much, Megan. How do our listeners find you, connect you? I'm sure they're going to want to see your designs. I personally am in love with them. That's how I
Thank you.
found you, because I saw your designs and I said, oh my gosh, need to have her on the show. But yes, let us know how to find you and how are we able to reach out.
Well, thank you for finding me. But Instagram's probably the best way. We post almost every day. I'm active on there. That's the best way to get a hold of me on like the social platforms, I guess. So Blue Copper Design on Instagram. And then we do have Facebook as well. We just don't check it as much. We have a growing Pinterest. So you can follow us on there, Blue Copper Design. It's Blue Copper Design everywhere. And then if you want to go straight to our website, it's bluecopper.design. I know it's a little funky, but we have links everywhere leading you there. Everywhere, there's links to everywhere.
Thank you so much for your time, for sharing your story, for sharing your journey, for even going further and explaining to our OT listeners how it's relevant to their work. So I really appreciate you for all of that. Thank you, Megan.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And that wraps up another inspiring episode of the Uncommon OT series. Connect with me at www.transitionsot.com. And don't forget to sign up to be part of the Transitions OT community. By doing so, you'll receive my latest compiled list of Uncommon OT practice settings, the latest news on mentoring offerings, Uncommon OT live events, non-traditional OT resources, and more. You may also follow me on my social media pages on Instagram and LinkedIn. And if you love this episode, head on over to Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, and Google Podcasts to follow, rate, and leave a review. I also ask you to consider pledging your support to my passion podcast project by being a patron on Patreon. It is very much appreciated. Sending big OT love. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.